Hi, and welcome to the X22 Report Spotlight. Today's guest is James Corbett. He is back with us. You can find his work on CorbettReport.com. He also has his incredible YouTube channel, Corbett Report. And I am very happy to have him back on the X22 Report Spotlight. James, welcome back to the Spotlight.
Well, thank you so much for having me back on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure to have you back on, and I really appreciate you taking the time out to come back on. And I wanted to talk about the Middle East and what is going on out there. Lately, we see the United States is back in Libya. They're bombing once again. And we're seeing Yemen is in complete chaos. Sudan, problems happening there. Iraq, still in Iraq bombing, and we're in Syria. What's happening in the Middle East?
It's a good question. I think we are seeing disorder, chaos, and increasing tendency towards violence and confusion, and things seem to be swirling out of control in a lot of different ways. But I think it's important to understand a couple of things. First of all, that although things certainly are not going according to plan, at least as they were presented to the public, that you will walk into Iraq and be greeted as saviors, and you know all of this will happen just like clockwork. That was the ostensible reason for the U.S. that gave the public for why it's going into here and there. But of course, I think that the actual agenda of the people who really are pulling the strings, which really aren't the nation-state governments that we tend to think of as being the actors in these different environments, I don't think that their plan is necessarily for the type of orderly transitions of power that we were expected to believe were going to take place in Libya and Syria and Iraq and everywhere else. So I think in those terms, it may be going exactly according to a certain plan, but whose interest and whose benefit does this serve? And again, I think it's important to understand that when we talk about these types of events, we usually talk about the U.S. or maybe NATO or the coalition of forces that include the French and British, or we talk about it in these nation state structure systems, but it's clearly in the 21st century, we are in a post-nation state environment. This is not wild conspiracy theory. This was even put out there years ago, 2008, Mini Kissinger, David Rothkopf put out a book called Superclass, where he said, yeah, we're in a post-nation state era. The actors that really determined things in the past, which were primarily nation states, along with some entities like the Vatican and like the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and mega interests like that, have always pulled the strings in the past. But now we're in an era where it's not even structured along those lines anymore. It is basically the transnational corporations and banking interests that run the shots. And this is someone quite on the inside of that system who knows a thing or two about what he's speaking. So I, again, this isn't wild-eyed conspiracy theory. This is the way it works. And for those interests, again, I think that the chaos and disorder is, in fact, part of the long-term plan, which is to create and foment the clash of civilizations, which has been talked about, written about openly for 2.5 decades now by crony-connected insiders to these elite power organizations, like the Council on Foreign Relations. Of course, The Clash of Civilizations was the title of a 1993 article in Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, that was then developed into a book in 1996. This is the same Foreign Affairs Journal that in 1998 had this infamous, or what should be infamous, issue that had a couple of very interesting articles. One was basically talking about the coming war on terror, the brewing war on terror, and how it was going to determine, the future, and terrorist events were going to be the catalyzing events of the 21st century. And another article was talking about Osama bin Laden and declaring war on the United States and what this is going to mean. So they were introducing the overarching theme of this story and the main character, the main villain of the story, right there in one blow. I think this is an engineered conflict, and it's not difficult to understand what's going on here. I think that they're really trying to consolidate power at a larger and larger level, and at a certain point, it's not nation states that are warring with each other, it's now entire civilizations that are warring with each other. And really, when you think about it, what better way to make Europeans, for example, feel European and feel part of some European collective than having this collective threat by these, you know, these stirred up Muslims. That creates the consciousness, the identity consciousness that is needed to get people to rally around a European Union flag. Conversely and perversely enough, although it seems counterintuitive, I think ultimately this strengthens global institutions to have this type of chaos.
Now, the president was out there, and I think today he just extended the bombing in Libya for 30 days. And he's saying that this is all for national security. When you hear this, when you hear, oh, this is all for national security, the security of the United States, what, in your mind, what does that mean?
Not much at all. I mean, it's political blather, generally speaking. If they are sincerely talking about security of interests, of course they're talking about security of interests for the banking and corporate elite that really call the shots in the first place. That is primarily what this is about. Geopolitics is about basically monopolizing squares on the chessboard so that they can use them and the resources in those squares for their purposes. Newsflash, this doesn't mean that, you know, the average American has a share in what's going on in Libya. They get to deal with the consequences of that in terms of the amount of money that's spent on military expenditures, let alone the type of blowback that we get in terms of, you know, the Islamic, the stirring up of the Islamic radicals and all of that. But none of the benefits really flow down to the American people in a tangible way. It has been that way for the past, you know, half century of the American Pax Americana, American superpower. Of course, people living under that shield have some tangible benefits, but I think those are starting to break down, and that's what we're seeing now. That's why we are seeing such massive disaffectment with the political establishment right now in the United States, in Europe, elsewhere around the globe. We're starting to see a massive backlash, and I think that is starting to perhaps peel back a bit of this curtain when they talk about security and national interests and, oh, we have to make this trade deal, you know, for the benefit of everyone. No, trust us, it'll work out for you. I think people are starting to not believe the politicians when they hear this, which is a good thing and a good sign. The next question is, well, you know, what are we going to do about it?
Now, I just wanted to move to the Turkish coup. Now, there are many theories out there. Many people have their own theories of what's going on, why it happened. I just wanted to hear from you and what your thoughts are on the Turkish coup, because we've seen Erdogan, I could say he's acting like a dictator in his country. And at this point, it looks like he's trying to assume all power. And he's blaming the United States for this coup. Other people are saying that he had a hand in this. From your viewpoint, who do you think was behind this Turkish coup?
Well, let's be clear about this. I think that, like so many of these situations, I don't think there's any angel involved here. They're all psychopaths of one part, sort or another at the top. And I think Erdogan, again, no real exception. He's in it for his own interests and aggrandizement and all of that. And is acting like a dictator in a lot of ways. So I would understand if the Turkish people hated what he was doing and the way he's running the country and were protesting and revolting against that, and it was a spontaneous kind of phenomenon. In the same way that, you know, I could understand the Syrian people not liking the rule of Assad or things of that nature. But as with in Syria, and as was the case in Libya and so many others, the fomenting of the protests and the backlash is absolutely taking place in a context that is fostered and created to a certain extent by outside interests. So I think we have to see this Turkish example in the same light. And in that regard, I think it's pretty clear that Erdogan has strayed too far from the NATO fold in a number of ways. And I think perhaps one of the big warning signs for the NATO perspective was back a couple of years ago when the European Council turned down the South Stream pipeline that was going to run oil across from Russia to across the Black Sea into Bulgaria, and then it was going to split off, and you know, some of it was going to go to Greece, some of it northwest into Serbia. That was the plan for the pipeline, and it was going to be a way for Russian oil to ultimately get in through to Europe other than through the Ukraine. So it was important to Russia. It was important to places like Bulgaria, it would have been a big economic boon for them. But European Council came in and put their foot down and said, you can't do that. We don't want that pipeline. And so Russia turned around and said, okay, we'll go through Turkey. And they started talks for a Turkish stream pipeline. This is going to be a multi-billion dollar deal. It was, I mean, hugely important for Turkey and for Erdogan, who was finding himself, I think, in a tighter position in a lot of ways in terms of the economy. So that was a pretty big development. But it, of course, meant Turkey becoming more friendly and hardwiring in relations with Russia. It's always important to understand that when pipelines are running between countries, in a certain sense, you are hardwiring relations between those countries, which is obviously uncomfortable for NATO, which is clearly more and more geared towards demonizing Russia, if not actually ultimately confronting Russia, but at any rate, making Russia into the boogeyman once again. And they don't want to see a NATO member getting that cozy with Russia. I think that has to be the context in which we see the rise of the enablement of the what we saw coming to a head in July. Now, in terms of the coup itself in particular, there are a lot of signs, there have been a lot of reporting, and a lot of this is in flux, so take it for what it's worth. But it certainly seems to be the case that there was going to be a military council meeting in Turkey in August, and the writing was on the wall that the Gulenist faction, which has invaded the Turkish military and government. And for people who don't know about Fethullah Gulen, he's this exiled imam who's now living in Pennsylvania on this massive estate there where he runs this multi-billion dollar, it's been estimated anywhere between 20 and 50 billion dollar global education organization that also has banking interests and newspapers, and all of this is being run by this exiled imam in Pennsylvania who had his green card sponsored by people like Graham Fuller of the CIA. So an interesting character, but he was exiled from Turkey back in the late 90s and ultimately prosecuted because it was believed he was inciting his followers to get into the Turkish government, basically to take it over and to create an Islamic republic, or a more outright Islamic republic. And so his faction has certainly infiltrated the top ranks of power in Turkey over the last couple of decades. And that faction has been being purged for the last few years by Erdogan. And there was this military council meeting, as I say, that was planned for August that was going to purge a bunch more from the military. So they basically had to act before that happened. And I think that's what the coup was ultimately about. Their hand was forced. They tried to go in July. The actual coup itself was fleshed out a few hours ahead of time by the MIT, the Turkish CIA, basically. And that basically threw the entire operation into chaos. They were supposed to, for example, take Erdogan and his family at their vacation resort at 3 a.m. But ultimately, they didn't even end up getting there because the coup was flushed out and everything got topsy-turvy. The coup plotters lost their main lines of communication. Everyone was acting kind of disconcertedly, and it ultimately failed. So I think that seems like the most likely explanation for all of this. It was a real internal coup that was taking place, and it really was this faction that represents these Gulenists that have their own interests but are being covertly supported by the United States and intelligence agencies. And there's this bigger NATO geopolitical game that's going on, and ultimately Erdogan now is fighting for his political life, if not his life itself. And that's why this crackdown is happening. And of course, in all of this, I mean, who are the big losers in all of this? Again, it's, of course, the Turkish people who are getting squeezed both ways, really, and don't really seem to have a lot of control over what's happening in their own country at this point.
So do you think because of this coup, Erdogan, Turkey is going to move closer now to Russia, China, Iran, and away from NATO and the United States?
It is absolutely looking that way. And we're starting to get into some pretty serious accusations that are going back and forth right now, with Erdogan now coming out and basically saying I don't think he's outright accused the U.S. of being behind the plot yet, but he certainly has said, well, you guys are supporting the coup plotters more than you're supporting me. You know, that's no way for an ally to act. And we had an interesting thing where GCHQ, the British version of the NSA, was leaking transcripts of phone calls and conversations that they'd apparently picked up during the Turkish coup, where they said, oh, you know, here's the Erdogan government. And they were talking about how they were going to blame this on Gulen and all of this as it was happening. And the GCHQ apparently leaked this to a German news magazine. I mean, it's pretty bizarre stuff going on. And keep in mind, again, these are ostensibly allies. I mean, Germany and Britain and the U.S., of course, are all part of NATO with Turkey. But they're now trading these back and forths, and the U.S. and others are coming out and saying that they hope that the Turkey will abide by the rule of law and all of this. These are starting to be some pretty serious accusations that are coming back and forth. And it looks to me like it is the deepening and the widening of the rift as Turkey perhaps is inching out from under that NATO umbrella and into the resistance bloc sphere of orbit, for lack of a better term, the Russia, Iran, China, that are clearly in the crosshairs of NATO. And I think along those lines, we will, if this is the situation and if this is how it's playing out, we will start to see warming relations as between Erdogan and Putin, as we started to see indications of just a month ago. We started to hear that Erdogan was talking up Russia again, and we're friends, we want to cooperate, we want to work together. So this all seems to be part of that, and I think that's the way this has to be read. And if Erdogan can maintain power and maintain those relations, then it is conceivable we could see Turkey getting out of NATO one way or another. And the interesting flashpoint in all of this is the Incirlik Air Base, which is part of NATO's operation sphere of orbit, because since Turkey acceded to NATO, the Incirlik Air Base has been a home for NATO nukes. It has been part of the NATO nuke arsenal in Europe since the 1950s, 1960s. And at this point, it is estimated that there are 50 gravity bombs, old-style dumb bombs that you would drop from a B-1 or bomber, that are at the Incirlik Air Base. And that happens to be a base where a lot of action was happening on the coup night. There were some KC-135 stratotankers that were apparently involved in refueling some of the coup plotters, fighters. And there, as a result, Erdogan came in afterwards with the surviving military and put the commander of that base in prison. They locked him up, and they shut down the power to the Incirlik Air Base for a week, which is amazing because, I mean, again, not only does it house the NATO nuke arsenal of 50 bombs, but also it is actively used by the U.S. Air Force, and in fact is an extremely important airbase for ongoing operations in Syria. They had to actually suspend operations, some of their air operations in Syria for the better part of that week when the power was out and they were scrambling around. And now it seems there's some type of blockade that is taking place, and I'm not sure how permeable that blockade is, but there's some sort of blockade of the Incirlik Air Base that's taking place right now. There was rumors swirling of a second coup that might be happening. So things are still very much up in the air. And keep in mind, this is a pretty important NATO base and a U.S. Air Force base that's part of all of this. So I think that's going to be perhaps the canary in the coal mine when it comes to what's really happening between Turkey and NATO.
So when we watch all this and we see this happening in Turkey, because the U.S. was using Turkey and the coalition forces were using that air base in Turkey to hit targets in Syria, does this pose a problem now? Because right now we have Russia, who's actually going after the terrorists. We have problems in Turkey and the U.S. What do? They're losing their forces in Syria, the moderate rebels, which they move back and forth into the terrorist groups. Russia is actually eliminating the Islamic State. They're losing Turkey as a place where they can stage these bombings in Syria. What does the U.S. do now in Syria? I know they're having talks with Russia about peace and ceasefire. Do they really want a ceasefire?
Well, again, if we're examining this from the nation state level, clearly the U.S. has lost control to the extent that clearly Assad was on the chopping block. They wanted him out. They clearly didn't get that. So from the nation state level and that plan, that level of the plan, that didn't happen. And it looks Like it may not happen. I mean, it certainly could happen, but there doesn't seem to be the momentum towards that. The momentum seems to be in the other direction. So it looks like Assad is going to hang on, and that means that there has to be some sort of face-saving measure. Now, something that has been floated in recent months, and again, it's still up in the air, but something has been floated is the idea of carving out some sort of Kurdistan, some Kurdish space in Syria for the Kurdish people that they would basically give to them that would be autonomous or semi-autonomous, something like the way that Iraq has essentially been broken up into its three blocks at this point, three power blocks, three regional areas. You have the Shia section, you have the Sunni section, you have the Kurdish section. It is effectively, I mean, not a single coherent country at this point. In the same way, I think the ultimate end goal at this point would probably be something like that for Syria, making a Kurdish section, making, you know, an autonomous section for Sunni elements, making, you know, maybe Damascus could be some sort of government type of place, but it wouldn't necessarily function across the whole of the country. And of course, that's also essentially what's happened in Libya, where there are now three official governments that all claim to be running Libya at the moment. None of them really are running the whole country. And the U.S. is now backing the provisional unity government, whatever it's calling itself. But that isn't going very well, and that's why they're calling in the airstrikes now. So absolutely, all of this is a chaotic mess, unless, of course, the plan is to create a chaotic mess, in which case things are running quite smoothly.
Isn't their ultimate goal, and I've seen this many times, where they wanted to take the Middle East and break it into these different regions, the Kurdish region, the Shia region, the Sunni region, and in Syria, the Alawite section, and to keep peace in the region, to keep the petrodollar supported, to keep everything separated so there's no fighting within the countries. Do you think this is still their plan and this is what they're actually moving towards?
Keep them fighting with each other so that they can't consolidate and create any kind of meaningful unity. Absolutely, that is part of the plan and has been for a very long time. And go back to the Pan-Arab movement and Nasser in Egypt and figures like that have been able or that were starting to rally people around the idea of unity and cooperation amongst various peoples and across nation-state borders that would form some sort of coherent bloc has always been the enemy, and it's always been, let's get a strong man in here, let's raise up the Muslim Brotherhood over there, let's find ways to get these people at each other's throats and divided and put people against each other. You know, the Iran-Iraq war was beautiful from the U.S. perspective because it for a decade they got to, you know, sell weapons to either side depending, you know, who they wanted to win, and they also get to keep that regional instability, the powers balanced against each other, so no one really comes out and is able to consolidate power across the region. So from that perspective, of course, that's what's happening. And we know that Israeli foreign policy, documentably on the record for at least two or three decades now, has been ultimately the establishment of a greater Israel, but towards that goal it is exactly about breaking up countries like Syria into warring factional regions that would be warring against each other. And from that perspective, then that what is happening now is mission accomplished. As long as they are fighting with each other, at each other's throats, destroying any hope of creating anything that would be able to resist U.S., Israeli, GCC dominance at this point in that region. As long as they can do that, I think that is the goal.
So what is next? What happens next now? I mean, Russia and the United States, they're in these talks. They were supposed to release something this month about this incredible plan that the United States came up with. And so far, we haven't heard it yet. But there are still rumblings that underneath this plan, they still want Assad to be removed. And Russia continually says, no, we're not going to remove Assad. The people have to decide who their president's going to be. Not like Libya, where the U.S. decided who the government was going to be in that country. Where do they go at this point? Because they've been trying to remove Assad, telling us that he's this evil dictator who tortures people, He has to be removed.
Of course, he tortured people for the U.S. for a long time.
Yeah, well.
Let's leave that part of it.
But, you know, they keep telling us this, and all of a sudden, they're going to backtrack and say, okay, you know what, he can stay. After we told you all this, he can stay now, and we'll just take the Kurdish region. Is this their only move?
It's difficult to see them getting everything that they want. There may be, I could imagine that Russia might give a little and do some sort of, okay, there'll be some sort of power sharing government or whatever. They might throw Assad under the bus. I don't think they're necessarily committed all the way to Assad himself. So he might be the political expedient that can be thrown under the bus in order to smooth things out. For the time being, you can have a little bit of face saving on both sides, because then the U.S. could say, hey, look, you know, we got rid of this dictator, and Russia could maintain their links to Syria and basically keep the invasion force out, which, of course, is the main concern. So I could imagine something like that playing out. Or, I mean, it's potentially possible that maybe the U.S. will not go for that, that ultimately they'll settle for something less than that and will deal with Assad. As being the head of Damascus, and just try to carve out as much space as they can for other areas to have some sort of autonomy. Kerry called that the plan B a while ago, and I really think that's been the plan A for a lot of the planners in there for a long time. So as long as they get that, I think their mission will actually be accomplished. It is a bit kind of egg on the face to have made all of this about the demonization of Assad, and then if they don't get rid of Assad, there will be a bit of egg on the face. But hey, it's the puppet changeover. It's the time of that time of the 8-year cycle where you clean out the birdcage to change the liner and put in the new bird. And, you know, all is forgotten, basically, and things move on. So maybe it's time for that kind of, okay, you know, we messed up. We didn't get what we wanted. You know, here's the new president. Here's the new puppet.
Are you nervous about the shadow government, neocons, Israel, those individuals that we really don't see? They're behind the scenes. Are you nervous about them maybe creating some type of an event to go into Syria or to make it look like something else is happening, where the forces need to maybe go into Syria and remove Assad or anything like that?
It's always a possibility. It's always on the table, and it's always just one event away, however engineered that event may be. And certainly I've always seen the potential flashpoint danger as being Turkey. If some incident happens in Turkey, or is something, you know, Turkish interests are attacked or what have you, because it is a NATO member, it could invoke the Article 5, is it? The mutual defense clause in the NATO treaty. And suddenly you've got NATO boots on the ground in Syria. That has always been a possibility, but now we have the added fun of this drama around the coup and the Incirlik airbase and the nukes. And, you know, if a nuke goes missing from an Incirlik airbase and ends up going off, you know, well, anywhere, really, I mean, that could be the kind of game-changing event that will require and necessitate all sorts of, well, it'll be a complete game-changer. So, again, I'm not raising that specter per se. I'm just saying it is another vector that could be used. So these types of events always could happen, and there will be people like you and I, and I'm sure many listeners out there, who will be skeptical of whatever story we're told in the wake of such events. But unfortunately, a lot of people won't, and the political momentum will likely be on the side of the people who engineer and perpetrate, or at the very least, take events and use them for their own agendas. So I think we have to be very wary for that, as always.
James, thank you very much for being on the X22 Report Spotlight. Once again, how can people see your work?
CorbettReport.com is the best place to go. CorbettReport.com. Thousands of hours of audio, video, media, articles, all up there for free viewing. If you like what you see, please do subscribe. I do appreciate the support.
Thank you very much, James.
Thank you.